Okay, my name is Sean Slusser. I'm here conducting an oral history with Eric Escobedo as part of the Valley Public History Initiative, Preserve and Restories. Today is March 10th, 2017. Start with an easy question. Can you tell us your name and your birth date?
Eric Escobedo. My birth date is September 23rd, 1981.
Cool, thank you. So usually I just like to start these off really general, so a little bit of your family history, kind of background, how you ended up here.
My family's originally from the Southwest, my mother's side, from Texas, New Mexico. Mm. And then my father's family, they're from all over. My grandfather is Army, retired lieutenant colonel, so they traveled a lot, so they didn't really have like a home state or anything, but... Yeah, I would say my roots are mainly from the Southwest.
Do you know when about they ended up in Fresno?
In the 50s. No, 50s.
So that would have been your grandparents?
Yeah, because my grandparents got married in Texas or New Mexico and then moved over into the Valley. And so we had a lot of family over here already because a lot of the agricultural work mm-hmm. was available to minorities. So... That's why they moved up here for labor.
And is that what they did when they got here?
That's what I was told.
Yeah.
They just worked out in the fields, basically, and just worked with their hands.
So you've had family here since the 50s?
Mm-hmm. California.
Do you know where they came to? Did they come to Fresno? Or they?
I know that some of my family is already here before. But my grandparents specifically, I think they came right to Fresno, but I know that they were in Tulare also. I have some family in Tulare in the South Valley. But I know that most of my mom and her siblings, they were born in Fresno.
Hmm. Were both your parents born here?
From my knowledge, yes.
What do you know about their kind of background?
My father was just, as far as, what do you mean, anything specific?
No, no
just my dad was what they would call an Army brat.
Okay.
So he moved around a lot. A few of his siblings were born in other states. Hmm. And I think he went to high school here. And my grandmother, his mom, is from Madera. So that's why I think they ended up settling back over here in the Central Valley. And he's just a blue-collar worker. I think he works for UPS now. He didn't go have any college, just graduated high school and had me a little bit after and just started working. And then my mother, same thing, just comes from a working background. She's first-generation Californian, so the rest of the family's from Southwest. I don't know much to say about that. They were just workers, the life of a minority, I guess, poor indigenous people. So they just were following wherever there was labor, available for them to do. And so, she didn't graduate high school and she just worked in retail. That's where they met. And
locally?
Yes. I think it was a Gottschalk's down in Manchester Mall back in the 80s. And then she met my dad over there, working over there, and then here I am.
Nice. What is your background, an ethnic background?
It's European and indigenous. My father's side is Irish, English, and Hispanic background. I think... we would call it like the Basque culture. Mm. Yeah. My grandmother's last name is Garibay. So a very uncommon Hispanic name. She says that we're from Mexico. I know they have some indigenous blood too, but I don't really know. I just know the European is just a Spaniard. Yeah. And then European. My mom's side is a mixture too, but primarily Native American. We're a Tarahumara, which is an indigenous tribe in northern Mexico, and then Mescalero Apache. And also have on that side of the family got some Spaniard blood too, and German.
So is that something they, your mom's side, did they talk about that a lot growing up? Was that kind of a part of your world?
Yeah. I was raised just by my mom, so I identify more with my indigenous heritage than I do my European. And they did too, because you know, they can't, I mean, you kind of have to identify with the color of skin you're dealt with, you know, because that's what most people identify you with. And so for them, they're just native. And this is, you know, they were growing up in the 60s and 70s, so it was very political time. And they had the a lot of that activist groups out there, Black Panthers, Brown Berets, and then AIM, American Indian Movement. And so that all that consciousness that was going on, I think, especially my her older siblings really identified with that.
Were they active?
My uncle was, yeah. And
in Fresno, or?
Yeah, in Fresno. And just involved with the community around here, even though we weren't part of the tribes around here, we just stood involved. And from what I know, it was always around other Indians, and just kind of was just, you know, not too many of them. My uncles got harassed a lot for having long hair, even though it was weird because it was the 70s, and I thought that was kind of a thing, but I guess where they were going to, and, you know, identifying as Indian, and all the Mexican Chicano people had short hair and made fun of them. And I know that there were a lot of the schools, they got kicked out of a lot of schools because they didn't want to cut their hair. Wow. It was against, I guess, policy to have long hair, for men to have long hair, so they got a lot of trouble. And my mom, same thing, she refused to stand up for the Pledge of Allegiance and got suspended from school, and didn't want to celebrate Columbus Day either. And you know, this is, you know, she's 13 years old talking about, I don't know how many 13-year-olds would talk about that back then, but she was, we're pretty aware of our ethnic background and our heritage, and pretty proud of it.
Nice. Do you know where that came from? Like, where they would have learned about that kind of stuff?
To be honest, that's the question I asked, because before that, my family's not very traditional. As far as, you know, we have very few connections to the actual tribe because of colonization and, you know, forced relocation and all that stuff. And from what I know of, it's just my grandfather just, you know, would always say, we're Indian. And then his parents were still alive, and my uncle went to go live with them, and they lived in Littlefield, Texas. And my great-grandmother is an indigenous Mexican, and a very stern woman. And so everyone kind of just gathered around my great-grandfather, from what I was told, and kind of that's where they learned about the background, that we're Apache. And the Tarahumara, the other indigenous tribe that I know that we are, comes from my maternal grandmother's side. And that they have they were a little more organized. I think they were had a little more money coming into, you know, the U.S., you know, because they were the ones that were married to the, you know, the European immigrants. I know that somewhere up there, a few generations back, I have a German great-great-great-grandfather. So it says on his records that his, you know, it's like primary language, when they give you, like, your immigration papers, right, it says German.
Interesting.
But he spoke Spanish also. And so they were able to keep, I think because of the fact they were with European people, and I know Mexico had a better record-keeping system back then, they were able to find out, trace the tribal roots a little easier than my maternal grandfather's side. But, I mean, you just look at my family, you can see right away what they are. So it's kind of written on the skin, right, so to speak.
So for you growing up then, were these things that you were exposed to, was it just kind of talked about, or were you going to, like, any kind of events?
Yeah, a little. It wasn't, I think my mom wanted us to kind of explore ourselves and what we wanted to do. Didn't force religion on us too much. I mean, we were baptized Catholic and went to catechism, but I think as soon as I got to about, like, you know, fifth grade or sixth grade, that kind of went out the window. She said, you know, you want to believe what you want, that's up to you. I'm not going to force anything on you. And, so two of my uncles were really traditional. All my uncles used to be traditional and were really identifying with that heritage, but I think as they got older, you know, and plus they all married and, you know, outside of the race, but, you know, they all, like, most of us are half white, My family, the Escovedo side, we say they love white people because they all married. All my cousins were all half breeds.
Okay.
And so it's pretty interesting. So I think we've always carried that with us and always carried that pride, but it was never really like we're not, as far as my generation goes, we weren't really like culturally involved. I mean, we went to powwows here and there, but that's hardly being culturally involved. To me, that's just like kind of like a social gathering with your own people. But I know that my little sister, my mom got her more involved and got her into powwow dancing and stuff. But yeah, it was very, I guess like typical American. You kind of like, you have either want to keep that heritage and identify with it, or you assimilate into the Western culture and just become a full American, you know?
Right. Did you have a sense of, was there like a, in Fresno itself, like a indigenous community or a community very for your specific tribes?
Yeah, very small. There are actually a lot of Southwest tribes were, you know, from my knowledge, you know, and then when I started paying attention, like in the 90s, we're here. They have a huge Yaqui population here, and they're from Arizona. That's where their reservation's at. And you have quite a bit of Apaches here. Apaches is a huge, huge nation. You know, you have different bands. You have them within Arizona. You have a couple of reservations in Arizona, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Texas. I mean, all northern Mexico, there's, you know, Apache people there. It's a huge nation. And a lot of them, the recognized tribes, a lot of those people are in the valley too. So it was pretty interesting to see them here. And then also you have, you know, the Mono people, you know, you got like Dunlap Mono, I know they're not recognized. You got Choinumni people, you got Yokuts. So you have all these different, you know, Chichansi, you have all the bands too, like different variations, but they were all here. And I knew about them just because of going to Roosevelt High School. You have a high indigenous population there that went. There's just a socioeconomic, you know, reasons, because poor people all kind of get bunched on one side of town, no matter what race you are. And well, for Fresno, mostly brown people are the ones that were poor. So kind of had a lot of natives there. And I had met an elder, one of my friends. He was just graduated high school. He took us around an elder, and he's Pascua Yaqui. And he kind of, he was my first experience with like someone who's heavily traditional, besides like my own uncle. And was really more political, and at that time I wasn't really aware of what was going on politically to the, you know, or cared about it, I should say. And he kind of like threw me in the mix of all that, got me started with community activism and stuff. So in the 90s, that's when I started finding out about all these indigenous groups that were here. It's just very small. I mean, even today it's very small, but Fresno State's always been a home for indigenous people. I mean, they've had the powwow, Fresno State powwow, for a long time. I mean, I used to go to it when it was in, you know, there's like a barn around here, or like, I know there's agricultural places, but yeah, there's like a area, it's like a barn or something. I remember going into the powwow back in, I think like 96 or something, and it was like dirt, and there was like all the booths set up around. It was very small, but that was the Fresno State powwow back in the day.
Interesting. Yeah. Before high school, was there anything that you, that did you know about this stuff before, or the things you kind of learned?
Just, yeah, a little. Like I said, we kind of would go off and on,
okay,
but it wasn't anything too major. It just wasn't, there wasn't a big enough support system here. The community is very small.
Yeah. So you, where were you born?
In Fresno.
Like Fresno proper?
Mm-hmm.
And so what are your kind of early memories of Fresno?
It's always been the same. I mean, as far as Fresno goes, I was raised by my stepdad. And my earliest memories of Fresno are the lowrider culture, Chicano culture, especially where I live. I live in southeast Fresno. It's heavy Chicano population. So a lot of that, he was in a car club called Valley Premieres. And he had a 65 Chevy Impala. His car's name was Chaos. It was it wasn't a show car. It was a hopper. So he had the hydraulics. And my earliest memories of Fresno are going with my mom and my stepdad cruising and just being exposed to all the car shows and just that culture of music, you know, like a lot of like the freestyle music was really big back then. So Stevie B, Lisa, all that stuff, man. So that's what I, that was, to me, that's what I saw. And
where's the main, like, kind of cruising area?
It, when I was little, it was Kearney Boulevard. And then when I was old enough to actually go out on my own, when the, right around the time that, that culture started dying out, mid-90s, it was Kings Canyon.
And so as a kid, what did it, what did that scene look like to you?
It was fun. It was fun. It was just about music and all these cool cars. I mean, it's kind of like a 24/7 like music video kind of. It's just like you're just around all this stuff. I mean, that's what I really remember from my childhood, like being real small. Was just, you know, my mom was always like into music and into going out and being a social butterfly. So I was exposed to a lot of that, like nightlife early. Not like as a, like a child, but like teens, like 14, 15, would see a lot of that. But it was already introduced to me as a baby because of the lowrider scene.
So other than the cruising, like what are the other kind of spaces of that lowrider scene? So are there like competitions and shows and whatnot?
Yeah, they would have car shows. I remember them being at Kearney Park. I remember them being at Holmes Playground and Fresno Fairgrounds.
And do you think that was mostly just local folks, or is that drawing from the valley?
I think it was all over, to be honest. I know that there would be people from LA that would come up, and people from like Vallejo and all that area that would come down. So I think it was easy for them because Fresno's kind of that area where it's not too far a drive. So if you want to catch LA folks and vice versa, Bay folks, come to the middle and meet. And so they had some pretty cool shows. And there was a lot of cars you would see, you know, like Lowrider Magazine was huge back then. Yeah. And so you would see a lot of the cars that were in spreads and stuff like there in person. So it's pretty cool.
Were there like concerts part of that?
Yes. Yes. I don't remember any of the concerts, unfortunately, but I'm pretty sure it was a lot of like the freestyle artists. I mean, I remember one concert. It was Mary Jane Girls. And that's mainly it. I remember like early 90s, like seeing Digital Underground too, one of the concerts.
Nice. So. Was there dancing there? I mean, like.
Yeah, yeah. It was, breakdancing's always been, I think, synonymous with car shows. I mean, that's where I would first go to kind of like see other breakdancers would be there. Would be at the car shows.
Would that be like organized or just like,
I think it was just
show up and
just
dance?
Show up. I know that they, before I was aware, they used to have like in the 80s, they used to have organized contests along with the car shows. But from my exposure, like late 80s, early 90s, it was just kind of like someone be bumping something and there's a space and then, yeah, they just make a circle.
Nice. What can you tell me about your neighborhood growing up? Like, whereabouts, you said southeast, whereabouts within that are you growing up at?
5th Street, 5th and Butler. It was dangerous, I guess. I didn't realize it until I got maybe like 5th grade, 4th grade. I didn't even know really what poor was until people started calling me poor.
Yeah.
You know, that's unfortunately how we find out where we stand. And, yeah. So it's a pretty, I mean, that's where the house that I grew up in was the house that my family, my mom and her siblings grew up in. So same part of town, real rough, real, especially in the 90s, early 90s, heavily, there's a lot of gangs around, a lot of drug dealing, a lot of that neighborhood violence. But also, too, you know, on the good side, there was community. Like, we all, the families had been there for generations already, and everyone was all tied in, and you knew people by last name. And if you knew their last name, most likely, like, somehow your families would be intertwined, and that's how it was for us. Like, there's a few families down in that part of town. I can still go down there and say my last name, and they're going to be like, oh, yeah, I know so-and-so. So there was that part. There was a community. You know, despite all the other bullshit going on.
Yeah. What elementary school did you go to?
Winchell Elementary.
Winchell? Like the donut?
Yeah. It was named after Elijah Cotton Winchell.
Who's that?
I don't remember. That's all I part I remember. Is where we had to learn his name and like a little bit of background. I'm assuming someone that had to do with military or politics. So usually who we name our schools after, well, back then.
Right. Yeah. What were the demographics of that school?
Hispanic, Chicano, however you want to label them, how they label themselves, and then Southeast Asian. And very low African-American population, very low Caucasian. So it's primarily those two.
This is always interesting about Fresno. Like, are you moving around the city, or is your world pretty much Southeast, or are you going to other parts of the city?
I got exposure to the parts of the city just because of my dad's side of the family. They're a little better off. Mm-hmm. So I got exposure to, you know, the Woodward Park area in the early 80s, 90s. So two different worlds. But my reality was Southeast. But, yeah, I saw that part of town, too. That's when I also realized that, I'm poor. You know, I share a room with three people, and then my dad said I found these guys. They got extra rooms. They have two living rooms and a dining room and a swimming pool and and a two-car garage and all this stuff. So let's just start finding out real quick what my situation was. But yeah, it's totally different being over here and over there. And that's when I start becoming more aware, too, of my ethnicity. And getting stares, going to restaurants with my dad's side of the family, and they were great people, still are. They never, you know, never treated me any differently. It was just being around that area and going to like a, I don't know, Denny's or something, and
right.
I'm this, you know, this little kid that looks different than everyone else, and I have raggedy clothes on, I'm a little dirty, and yeah, I remember getting stared at a lot. It was pretty unfortunate.
So within Southeast Fresno, then, like, what are your favorite kind of, like, what were your, like, favorite spots, or, like, what are you doing on weekends, like, and stuff?
Are we talking, like, teenage years?
Yeah, either one.
Yeah, just, there was not really too many places to go. I mean, it would be someone's house, usually, you know what I mean? Or someone had a garage, because I was already into dancing. By the time I got to eighth grade, I was already hooked on it. So you just find someone who had like a garage or a basement or something, and it would be how whoever's mom would or grandmother would tolerate us at the time. We would go and we just kind of post up, and then we started getting an opportunity to go to the parks. They stopped kicking us out finally and started letting us in, and so we would occupy the gym, Romaine's, Holmes Playground, Mosqueda Center. It's kind of the three parks that all the dancers from that area would kind of bounce to. There was a Boys and Girls Club too, but
those are all in Southeast Fresno.
Boys and Girls Club, yeah, all those places. This is all Southeast.
Okay, so for Winchell, what was your middle school?
Sequoia Middle School.
And is that more or less the same kind of population?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, we had a little bit more of a mixture. We had a little more of a African-American presence there. Still very low, Caucasians, really too many, but primarily Southeast Asian and Hispanic.
What were your interactions with Southeast Asian? Were you, like, cool with them?
At first, no. It was real rough. I had friends in elementary school that lived in the neighborhood, and they were Hmong. And we were pretty cool to walk home together. But as you got to middle school and the gang violence escalated, it created a lot of barriers between ethnic groups, because you had, you know, the Hispanic gangs, which were like the Bulldogs, F-14, Sutrese, you know, you had all these people, Norteños, Sureños, all that stuff. And then you have Southeast Asians who had TRG, Tiny Rascal Gang, Asian Crips, Lao Bloods, ABs, which are called Asian Boys. You had all these groups, and you kind of get pulled into those directions. Even if you're not necessarily gang affiliated, you'd still kind of, you pull into those groups because they kind of run things socially. And the interaction was real, there's a lot of friction, because you didn't know. It's like, oh, you know, you're Hispanic or whatever, you're a bulldog or whatever. Oh, you're Asian, you got to be a TRG or something. So that those labels, you know, we're you know, you're middle school kids, you throw labels on each other all the time, and unfortunately, it created a lot of racial tension in the school. But towards the end, because I fell in love with breakdancing, I started having a different interaction with a lot of the Southeast Asian groups, because a lot of them were either gangbanged or you breakdanced. And so I started finding out that, you know, there was actually some cool groups in there, and kind of stick with them, actually, because a lot of the Hispanic people weren't, and that's mainly what I grew up with, a lot of them were into breakdancing. To them, it was like old 80s, you know, bullshit. They didn't really care about it. And so they stayed with like either playing sports or being gangbangers. And I felt like the Asians were athletes, like with breakdancing or gangbanging. So it became real cool and opened up the door. And, like my best friend growing up was Vietnamese.
It sounds like is that middle school is kind of the break point where things kind of start dividing along ethnic lines, or was that before?
Yeah, I feel like it. I feel like that's when it happens. My mom, I went to the same elementary school as they did too, and the same middle school, and they told me the same thing. Except back then there was a lot more, you know, Caucasian people there. So that barrier started there too. Like they would, because the way my uncles looked, and they liked white women. A lot of the Hispanics would try to fight them, call them honky lovers, and so they said it started in middle school, a lot of that racial division, and it carried on in high school. And I felt the same way. It's where, you know, elementary, you don't, you know, you have your friends, you don't really think about color or culture too much. It's when you get to middle school and these things are thrown on you, and that's where you start seeing that split, and it gets real rough.
And so gangs are pretty ever just kind of around on a day-to-day basis, and they have to negotiate?
Yeah. I had the street I live on, Fifth Street, there's a gang called Barrio Fifth Street, BFS, and they're actually still around. Back then, they were kind of just getting started, and one of my older cousins was affiliated with them, and it was just people that we grew up with. And I was telling you before, it's like families, you know, and so I think for them, they're like about 6 years older. So during the 90s, they're like, you know, teens to 20s. And so they started this, you know, whoever started the gang, but they all got involved. And I was fine with them. I got a pass because they knew who I was. Mm. But, you know, you go like a little bit up a ways just to get to school, and all of a sudden you're in a different street, and there's a whole new gang, a whole new set of people you don't really know. If you're wearing the wrong color, if you look at them funny, you can't even look at people if they walk with your head down, if you won't get your ass beat. So sometimes you just kind of like walk a whole different way just to get to that same point, just to avoid the gangs. And then if you go like near like the Asian neighborhood, then you're shit out of luck if you're not Asian, because then you're really gonna get it. So yeah, it would get rough, especially when I went to Roosevelt, because that was about a mile and a half, 2 miles away. And that walk was crazy, because then I'm going up to like other like neighborhoods that I don't have no familiarity with, and they're just like already, you know, trying to like kick my ass. So I have to like, yeah, walking home in high school like for the first year was a real challenge, because I had friends that were gang members, but I wasn't really a gang member. I'd get in fights, but it was because they were my friends and I was backing them up, not backing their gang up. And that became different when I got to high school, kind of started splitting ways, because I was more involved with dancing. But still living in the hood, it's just like, it doesn't matter what you do until you build up a reputation, and I didn't have one. So I was just scared walking home. And I think that was for a lot of kids, like you kind of walk home in groups to make sure, like, you know, strength in numbers, so... If you're in a bigger group, most likely they ain't gonna mess with you if there's only two of them.
Interesting. So what is your introduction to dance? Like, what was the...
My cousin was probably the first one I saw that was doing anything. He was doing like a lot of the, what do you call it, housing? I don't know. But it was mainly like like Belle Biv DeVos, like Vanilla Ice, Hammer, like a lot of that like hip hop dancing back then, but like it was all like kind of meshed with housing, you know, like everyone called it housing for some reason. Anything that was affiliated with hip hop, I think for that small one of like 88 to like 91, it would be called like housers. And so before he got into like gangbanging, him and a few other guys in the neighborhood were all watching like MTV and picking up those dance moves. So that's where I started watching, being exposed to it really.
And so how does the story progress from there? Like,
Get to middle school and I'm in the gym and I see one of my, everyone's like, there's gonna be a battle. So like, oh cool, I'm gonna go watch. And go into the gym, and it's Halloween, and one of the teachers there, he's dressed as Bob Marley. He's an English teacher. His name is Mr. Branch. Remember, he had the dreads and he had the hat and everything. He was like supposed to be like a Rastafarian. I'm like, all right, this is a teacher. The hell. And it was an eighth grader, and I can't remember his name. His name is Raimundo, and he's like calling them out. And it was a popping battle at first, and they were kind of like going at it. And then the teacher is like, all right, sorry. And he just throws off his hat and just kind of goes into some breaking moves, goes into like a windmill, into a backspin. Everyone's like, what? Uh-huh. And so that kind of like all the kids went crazy. It was like, you know, he can do that. And then within that was in the fall. And then the spring semester, he started offering a breakdancing class after school. And from then on out, that's when I started just kind of being around dancing.
This is at?
Sequoia Middle School.
When you saw it, did you know what it was?
Yeah, just from TV. And then, like, you know, random, like, quinceañera or wedding or something. Someone tries to do it. But that was, I think, the first time I saw, like, legit, like B-boy moves.
What did the breakdancing class entail? Like, what's...
It was mainly just he would just do terminology and do basic moves. Like, he would mix popping with breaking. I mean, everyone, that's what it was back then. Everyone mixed the two, especially on the West Coast. And so, like, I remember he taught us the moonwalk, but he said it was called the camel walk. And then taught us, like, some basic, like, footwork fundamentals. He didn't call them six-step. He didn't have any of the East Coast terminology. He called it, like, a scramble. And so I learned that in a backspin. So it was real, real basic. I mean, we're middle school kids, so we really couldn't really do too much yet. And so, yeah, he would just like, I think it was once a week we would meet up. It was a Wednesday. I'm pretty sure it was a Wednesday after school. And that went on for that semester, and then he stopped doing it. So a lot of the breakdancers were eighth graders, and so they all went on to high school. I think it was like me and like two other people were the only ones that were seventh graders at the time, so he just stopped offering it. And then for that whole year, I didn't really do anything because there was no one to do it, like dance with, so I kind of just took a little break.
So that would have been like eighth grade year?
Yeah, and then got to like eighth grade summer. We had like a dance at a summer school, and I started trying it again. And then high school hit, and I didn't really do anything at first. I was still hanging out with the gang, kind of the gangbanging group. Those were my middle school buddies. And then one day they were having like music out and there was these guys popping. And so I just went out and started doing it. Everyone was just like, what? You dance? And I was like, yeah. And they're like, what? You're hella good. And then so I was like, oh, am I? It's like, okay. And it was just from then on out, just like, let's just keep on doing this. It was fun. You know, who doesn't want to like be called cool in high school, you know? Right. So I was like, all right. So I just kept on sticking with it. Practicing.
So that was just like a kind of cypher type or just hanging out?
Yeah, it was a cypher thing. Because I had seen it, like, that transition between hanging out with the gangbangers and, like the hip-hop people. Like, I saw, like, Climax dancing at a few of the dances. And they were, you know, like, really good already. They were already doing continuous head spins, windmills, you know, like, all these power moves. And I had, like, in combinations, too. And so I had never really seen it, like, done that well. And so just watching them kind of, like, in the corner, just like, man, like, I wish I would have stuck with it. And then so one day I just started coming out on my own, but I was just mainly doing popping. And after a while, like, Charles and I, we started doing ciphers at school, like at lunch. It'd just be him would start a cipher, and all of a sudden, like at lunch, you'd have like, you know, 200 kids watching us, and we'd just be him just dancing. And we'd do that often. And then after a while, it just started turning competitive between me and him. And that's when high school beef started. And that was like my freshman year.
Who's providing the music?
The activities director would have some of the students go out, because they had, you know, the other people that do like the signs for football games and all that. He would have them go ahead and take the sound system out that they would use for football games, take it into the quad and just play whatever.
Were they doing it like for your crew, like for site, or that was just like for the school in general?
Not at first. That came after. Okay. Yeah, because they started seeing that, I think because activities director took notice and the faculty took notice that it was like breakdancing is becoming popular again. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of population doing it at that school. That they started having specific things, like they had like a battle. They would start having battles for us at lunch. And then they would have a few other like different...
Coming right up.
Thank you, Siri. You're spying on me. Yeah.
She wants to battle.
Yeah, right? Coming right up, you get served. Yeah, the schools kind of just started facilitating activities for the dancers and gave us access to the cafeteria. Roosevelt was a school of the arts, so a lot of the dance instructors, too. We have like four or five different dance instructors. Wow. And I think they weren't supportive at first because, you know, especially back then, they were, you know, breakdancing didn't really, they're kind of like still a bastard child of dance. Mm-hmm. I felt like they weren't really supportive. They didn't give us access to you know, the dance studios, because they had mirrors, you know, actually legit wood floors and stretch bars and mats, and they didn't. We were always stuck in the cafeteria, or like, man, we would dance out in the basketball court outside on concrete. Wow. If it was smooth enough, just because that's, you know, just so, you know, all we needed was like a floor, a space. And so we're just doing that.
Did that change over time? Did they eventually get you access to the studios?
No. Even all the way up until I graduated. I think I got to go in the studio maybe twice. Yeah, they just didn't. They were saying, "Oh, you're gonna break this. You're gonna ruin that." And this is like, "What are you talking about? You got people in here with tap shoes on and folklorical shoes, stomping on the floor, and you worried about us like scuffing the floor?" So I think, it was just a bias, because it was a undisciplined dance, quote unquote. And it wasn't taught in universities or anything. You couldn't get a degree in it, so they kind of just looked at it as. I think they felt like we were just trouble. I mean, most of us looked like we were gangbangers, ex-gangbangers. We looked the part still. And I don't think they really trusted us fully. And a lot of the School of the Arts people were from, not even from, it's a magnet school, so they weren't even from Southeast. It was a lot of Northside kids with money. You know, primarily like Caucasian kids. You had other ethnicities in there, but they always like, they had their own office, they had their own staff, they had their own funding, they had, you know, full access to all the facilities that were for music, art, dance, and there was hardly ever really interaction with the regular population of students with we called them the RSA kids, the School of the Arts kids, and so it was always like a continuous thing. They would embrace this once in a while, but I felt like more it was to benefit them. Like if they would have a show and they were charging, they knew if they had us, like our families would show up in full force. And I felt like we were being exploited in a way, even by our own school, just to draw in numbers to pull in money for, you know, I don't know, costumes for a big show or something. I don't know, whatever they're raising money for. So that's when they would embrace this, and they would throw us a cookie. And say, "Oh yeah, you guys can use the studio for the rehearsal for the show. Then after that, that's it." Otherwise, we were like stuck in like hallways and wherever there was a smooth floor. it's kind of aggravating in a way, because you're in a school of the arts and you're dancing, you're in performing art, and because it wasn't something they valued, you didn't get access to all those things the other artistic kids did. And I felt like we were probably, looking back as an adult, like we were in need of that access more than any of those other privileged right. kids were. You know, they were going to be fine no matter what. They had, most likely had both parents at home. You know, they had all these things, you know. They had a foundation and we didn't. You know, some of us would stay after school to get a snack or something, because that was the last time of the day we were going to eat. You know, we'd stay an after-school program or go to a park when California, before I think it was at Gray Davis, cut out the free snacks. But that was the last time most of us were going to eat. We needed these things. We needed access to the school, and they never really supported us fully. And they would take these other dancers, and some of them were not very talented, to be honest, but they were involved in that program. And they would take them New York, Los Angeles, you know, go see all these great places and all exposure to all these other dance companies. And it's like, never really took any interest in any of us. And as you know, like someone like Charles Montgomery's and Pablo Flores, like they were, you know, internationally known.
Right.
You know, even in high school, they were becoming known statewide. And these guys, you know, end up changing the world. And it's like, you would think, imagine if they would have had that support system in high school, how much more further they could have got with it.
Even the lunchtime stuff, do you think that was unique to Roosevelt or other schools? Was that going on?
It was going on in other schools. We start finding out later as we started branching out. Mm-hmm. And we started finding out there was kids at like Bullard that were dancing. Central High School had a few break dancers. They started saying the same thing, that they would dance at lunch and stuff, and same thing, they would just have music out and they would kind of just do an impromptu dance circle. But there was still nothing, there was still no like support from those schools either.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it is why they were so at that time, even now, because I worked at schools, not very supportive of breakdancing. I don't know what it is about it that they don't like. I still don't understand the stigma. It's a beautiful thing. It's, you know, it's homegrown American goodness, and people still are hesitant to throw any support behind it. People with means to actually affect change don't throw, you know, any force behind it. It's a little unfortunate. But they had stuff going on there, and we started, like, I don't know how people, like, mainly the mall, to be honest, the mall and Fashion Fair and Manchester. Be mainly the malls, because you're just like, oh, there's a floor and it's breakdance on it. You get kicked out, but then all of a sudden you'd be dancing, and then all of a sudden some kids you've never seen before on the other side of town are just like, oh, we dance too. So that's why I met a lot of, like, other people. And then car shows in the 90s, you'd meet other dancers. So, I mean, there was no Facebook, there was no social network at all. So you kind of would just luck, just out of nowhere, just, oh yeah, we go to Bullard, we live off of, like, you know, Herndon. You're like, oh, okay. You breakdance up there? Like, yeah. And for us back then, like, I think especially when you're little, like, small as Fresno is, it was like they lived in a totally different world right. than we did. And so I started building up a little network with, like, other groups. And it was, like, kind of like a neighborhood, like, thing. And it was weird because even just within the neighborhoods, people, I think New York had this similar experience, like, within the Bronx. People from different parts of that city had different styles, and noticed that also with Fresno.
So what did that look like? What are the different styles? Or
I felt like the guys from, like, Northside had a little more footwork, a little more flavor, less power moves, and more focused on, like, freezes and stuff. And then, like, the Southeast guys, especially because of the Asian influence, you know, all the power moves were really there. It was like a solid foundation. And then everyone popped. Everyone popped. or had someone in their crew that was popping. A lot of the Northside guys actually did both. They were like me, where they didn't really focus. I think maybe that's why they did a lot more style, like me, because it's like, if you're gonna be a power mover, that's kind of like a full time commitment. That's you really gotta bust your ass to get like those kind of moves down. You know, you have to stretch, eat right, work out. And I'm sitting there eating hot Cheetos and drinking soda. So I wasn't interested in that. I was just there for the creativity. And I felt like I clicked really good with the Northside guys. So they were more into that stuff too. But popping and breaking were not separate things for us. It was one thing. I think that was just the hip hop culture, the b-boy culture in general back then. It was real. We're all celebrated together, and even in Fresno, it was like that. Even though we hadn't really no real exposure to other cities, other big cities, we still had that. We still reflected that bigger picture of just like having poppers and breakers together. And the Northside guys, more flavor. East Side guys, more power.
So where are your, like, where are you seeing these, like, to kind of base your moves off of and stuff? Like, what's your influence?
I had one video, one bootleg of B-Boy Summit 3, an event in San Diego. I'm pretty sure you're familiar. Yeah, it's B-Boy Summit 3. Actually, I had a bootleg with a graffiti video. B-Boy Summit 1 and 2. It was a bootleg of that with a crew called the Tits, graffiti crew tapping into the system. It was a bootleg. It was that video of them bombing and doing all kinds of, like, that was like Jackass before there was Jackass, right. Like all kinds of nonsense mixed up with graffiti. And then at the end of that, it was cut into B-Boy Summit. And that was like kind of where I based off. I didn't really take any moves, just kind of just watch it and just be all fascinated because, I mean, that's Rocksteady Crew. And back then, they were like the pinnacle of, like, they were the responsible for the resurgence, them and Air Force Crew. So these guys are doing stuff that, like, I thought the videotape was on fast forward, like, as quick as these guys were moving. I was like, is this fast forward? And I was like, these guys, you can move that quick? And so that's where that video would circulate around, like, and then B-Boy Summit 3 came my sophomore year in high school. And that had Style Elements versus Rocksteady Crew. And that tape circulated. And I think that one influenced me more with moves, like with popping, because Mr. Wiggles had a segment in there. And it was just like all for popping. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was still mainly focused on at that time. And it just like blew my mind. But I know that other dancers around town also had access to that video, and they were picking up moves from it. So, like, Style Elements and Rocksteady.
Do you remember where you got the video from?
My guess is Mikey Ice. He's from Madera. He's Zulu Nation affiliated.
At the time already, or?
I think so. I know that he was affiliated with Style Elements also. Because they lived in Modesto, and he was in Madera. And so I think he's the one that had access to the tapes and just bootlegged it, because he was like the bootleg king back in the day. That's what everyone knew him as. So I'm pretty sure it was he was responsible.
So how would you, at the time, like, what were you, like, what kind of, what were you calling this? Were you calling it popping, or?
Yeah, we're calling it popping. Yeah, we... caught popping, and then there was breaking. I think we knew what locking was, but no one really tried it because it was too hard. I felt like it was too hard of a dance to do, and there wasn't too many examples of runoff of that weren't from the 70s. But we identified them, as, I think, as their proper terms. Like, I learned the term B-boy in like 95, and so it wasn't too much far out from when I first started, like a year out.
And so, for popping in particular, did you know about kind of Fresno's history?
No, not at all. I mean, not the big popular history like Electric Boogaloos, but I knew history just from, you know, being around the car shows and stuff and seeing people out there. Like, there was, like, crews called, like, the Dragons, And actually, that guy that when I was telling you about that hip hop store, the guy's name was Dragon, and his crew were called Dragons. And just a lot of those guys. So they were probably now they're probably in their 50s.
Yeah.
And seeing them, but like they didn't really talk about, like I heard like there was Dragon's crew. I heard there was like, you heard about the electric, but like everyone would like always say Boogaloo Sam and Popping Peter from Fresno, or they have roots in, like you'd always hear that, but beyond them being around or anything, there was nothing like that. So it was just mainly just like people like me that weren't really have any names for themselves, just kind of just doing it.
So you didn't have a sense of what you were doing was like a Fresno thing?
No, not at all. I thought it was, honestly, I thought everything, even popping, I thought it started in New York when I first started doing it. But then you get like all these like popper, like cause I would do something at a car show, like 12, 13 years old. And then you get like these older guys coming out and they're just like really good. And I was like, and to me, they're old, but they're like 30.
Right.
And you're just like hitting and you're like, man, I used to do that back in the 80s and 70s. And I was like, really? And they're like, yeah. And of course, everyone references Breaking the movie. He's like, you know, Turbo Ozone and all those, you know, the other guys. It's like, yeah, I used to battle with those guys, man. And they started naming like Dickie's Playground, you know, started naming all these parks and stuff. And so you get like, you get it here and there that there was like a, like, back then I knew there was like a history of popping, but as far as it being, a lot of the moves being pioneered here, I had no clue. Even back then, I didn't really think much of like Pete or Sam. Like my hero was Mr. Wiggles, and Mr. Wiggles is from, you know, New York. That's who I am. And Charlie Rock, you know, Mr. Freeze, like these guys that popped were all from the East Coast. The only one that I knew that was like West Coast solid when I first started was Mr. Animation from LA. And beyond that, didn't know, had no idea.
So even those New York people, are you learning those mostly through these videos and stuff?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Wiggles is probably, like, my biggest influence for popping. I still admire him even to this day. But, yeah, I would say that was my first exposure to someone who could actually, like, hit real hard, besides animation. No Sam, no Pete yet. I mean, besides the movie Breaking, there was no footage of Pete or anything. I didn't really get exposed to them until like I actually had to start going down to LA.
Okay.
And then I felt like Rocksteady Crew, probably, you know, was responsible for those guys kind of coming back too, because when they came to start doing the B-Boy Summits, the first few were just mainly geared around Breaking, but I think 99 B-Boy Summit really, now I'd already been dancing for like 4 years by at that time, really started embracing the funk styles and started like, oh, this is your history, you know, you're from the West Coast, these are your roots. And they start talking about the Lockers and start talking about poppers. And I think that's when I think 99's, they had the Locker show. I didn't go to 99. I went to B-Boy Summit 2000, but the 99's when they had the Locker show. And then in 2000, they had the whole funk styles, like Cypher and Battles. And that's when I met Skeeter Rabbit. And then Pete was there. I didn't get to meet him. But it was Pete, Rabbit, Wiggles, a few of the other OGs that are from affiliated with Electric Boogaloos.
Interesting. So in the Roosevelt scene, are you guys in crews yet?
Yes. There's a Climax crew, which I wasn't a part of. I was a rival with them. My crew was just a popping crew. They're called Outer Realm. And it was me, this other Native American brother named Freaker. He was, like, to me, like, true school 80s era. Like, I don't know who he learned from, but he had that flavor still in the 90s. Real 80s flavor of popping and breaking, and he was my first teacher, like my first like real like mentor with popping.
Is he older than you?
Yeah, I think he's 2.5 years older. And so I started learning from him, and it was all a lot of like his buddies that were, so they were, when I was a freshman, they were juniors and seniors. And so that's where I kind of got my foundation. That was my crew, and we're just mainly like poppers. We didn't really break. But for some reason, we'd still have a rivalry with Climax, even though, like, they were break dancers. It was really weird. And there was, like, a couple other, like, guys around campus that were, like, poppers. And it's because of their dad or their uncle or older brothers or whatever. They were dancers in the 80s. So they kind of taught them, too. I think a lot of people from the 90s were related to someone who danced in the 80s or around, mentored by someone from the 80s. That generational, passing the baton, you know, down. And you had our crew, Outer Realm, and then you had Climax. And then you had Smurfs, Wizards, Mystical Illusion. It went by the name M.I. Bums Crew. And then Lunacy.
Are all of these mixing, breaking, and popping?
I think so. I know that Bums had, they were a little older. And they had stopped a little bit after. They were doing both. Like they were housers, more of the houser identity, because they're a little older. So they were around when the housing thing was going on. So they had a more of like a, I don't know how to put it. Their style wasn't like strictly like B-boy. There was no mannerisms of that like toughness. They were just real kind of like real quick and then just like would do some flares and windmills and that was it. But they would also pop. And their popping wasn't really like what you think of today, like traditional popping. They were mixing like housing moves with it. Real like more like a freestyle like movement than any like real discipline, but it had popping moves in it and breaking moves in it. They're a little older and they had popping. Climax at that time didn't have any poppers. Only one guy, their leader, their founder, Flip Eric Costello, he popped and braked, and he went to middle school with me. And he had an injury early on, so he was just popping mainly at the time, and he wasn't really taking it seriously. He was one of those people that can just do it because he was good at it. He just picked it up real quick and was like, oh, yeah, I can do it. But besides him, Climax didn't really have any. They were mainly just like B-boys. MI was a mix. They had, I saw them a lot at car shows. They were poppers and breakers. And then Smurfs had a guy named Lumpy. His real name is Viltow. He popped and braked. And, yeah, you had a mixture.
Are most of these crews, are they kind of ethnically mixed, or are they specific?
Specific. Smurfs, Hmong, Southeast Asian, Wizards, or primarily just Hmong, nothing else. Bums are Hispanic. Climax was mainly Hispanic or Black. And then my crew, we were... Yeah, Hispanic or indigenous. Yeah, there was really no.
In the MI, are they?
All Hispanic, all Latino.
So compared to, like, you're saying at the same time, there's the kind of gang divisions on ethnic lines. Was there any kind of beef kind of in these kind of crew scenes?
Yeah, but it wasn't. Wasn't as serious, I would say, because you'd still talk to people. There wasn't like if you were walking with someone from another crew, it wasn't a big deal. Okay. Yeah, so it's not as serious, but like when it came to dancing, then it got serious where you kind of like, you gotta stand your ground with your crew. But beyond that, it was pretty just open. I mean, I had classes, you know, a lot of us went to the same high school. You had classes together, you're gonna talk. So it would get heated once in a while, but it wasn't too bad. And they would have contests like out like at you know, like a park or something. Then you kind of like get people that didn't go to school with that were in those crews. Then it would kind of, that's when a little more tension would build up. But it wasn't anything too bad. Like there may be like in the history of Fresno, there may be like 4 or 5 serious fights, and that's it. Out of like the, you know, hundreds of battles that have happened, so not that bad.
So are you guys battling on campus?
Yeah, like I'm battling mainly. It's me battling Charles mainly at first, and then I met my friend Dat.
And then he was actually breakdancing. And so me and him started hanging out. And this is like my sophomore year. So all the those poppers that I was learning from graduated. And so me and him were just, we had no crew. We were just kind of just dancing on our own. And yeah, it was still kind of like beefing with Climax. But then I started hanging out with them at the same time too. It was weird because I was cool with the main guy, Flip. And at that time, I was, like, getting into, I think they didn't really see me too much as a threat anymore because I was getting more into, like, the rave scene and stuff. And I was, like, being exposed to, like housers and freestyle dancers and stuff. So I think for that reason, they were, like, you know, they really sweat him. He's not trying to, like, do what we're doing. And so, I would kind of, like, kind of linger around on, you know, on the outside of that whole little inner circle. I think more so like I was tolerated more than I was welcomed around most of them. There were a few of them that were like legit, like I consider them my friends, but I think most of them were kind of just like sneering at the fact that I was around, and they were real happy when I stopped hanging around them. So it was real hard because it was like these are people that are older than me and I look up to them, and I think they're great at what they do, but at the same time they're acting like dicks. So it was just like it was real hard because there wasn't too many other dancers around, especially like, you know, that were my age or I can relate to. We're from the same part of town. So it was real weird. Like, you're an outsider in your own community. Real hard to deal with. But that's why me and my friend Dad, we kind of stood on our own. And then all these other, like, ragtag misfit dancers started coming our way. And I think we actually became, like, the most diverse, like, ethnically diverse crew in Fresno for a long time. And we started a crew with a guy who's actually, he was born with muscular dystrophy, and I saw him at a car show, and his cousin was, like, a really good dancer, and he was like, hey, I'm gonna start this crew up, it's like a hip-hop crew, and it was called Out of Control, and so I brought all my friends from, like, Roosevelt along, and we just formed that crew, and it was, I think at that time, my friend Dat was the only Asian dude in it, and everyone else is, like, brown. But when we got to our junior year, this is when Climax is on the way out there, as they were seniors, we had, like, a legit crew of, like, 20 people, and there was, like, my friend Lawrence, this is sort of talking about, like ethnic diversity. My friend Lawrence is half Japanese, half black. He was in our crew. My friend Dat's Vietnamese. I'm mixed European, Native American. Had my friend Luis, he's Puerto Rican. I don't know how he ended up in Fresno. We tripped out on it. I was like, dude, you should be in New York, Puerto Rican. But we had my friend Dat's brother, who's also Vietnamese, obviously. Then my friend Freaker, Native. My friend Reggie, who was in it for a little bit. He was, I think he was Italian. His last name's Lavero. So I'm pretty sure he was Italian. And then we had this guy named Rafi. He was Armenian. Came along later. My friend DeMarco is African-American. And so we started like gathering, and like after a while, we were like the UN of like B-boys in Fresno. And Climax had a little bit of a mixture by then, but I think mainly we were all kind of, like I said, misfits. And that's kind of like the common thing we had. Like, we weren't as good as the other guys. But we didn't really care. We're just like there just for fun. We weren't trying to like travel out of town or anything. We just wanted to stay in Fresno and dance and just goof around. And so we kind of had that all in common.
Is this still during high school? Or is this,
okay. Yeah, this is like my junior year. All kind of just like nerdy guys that just break dance. And
so outside of high school, like what are the kind of spots you're going to dance?
Around that time, just mainly Holmes Playground and Mosqueda Center, just bouncing back and forth there. And then one of my friends started teaching that year. His name's David. His garage became like the center. Okay. And that was when we started getting more exposure to the Bullard people, like the Northside guys who were a little younger. And his mom, God bless her, she tolerated so much. There would be like, it was a one-car garage and there would be like 22 kids in there, 22 teenage boys. Some of them that you just don't want around, period. Like, a lot of my friends were, like, pretty big potheads and very rude. And so they'd be smoking weed, like, right there inside of the house with her window open. And she's like, what the hell? And they lived in that neighborhood, like, back then was decent. It was, like, middle class, almost upper middle class. So they
Where
were
was that at?
Off of, like, Shaw and, not Valentine, Shaw and Marks, around that area. So back in the 90s, that area was still kind of decent. And so a lot of folks weren't happy with our presence. So the garage is open, music's blaring, and we're there, like, you know, we're kids, so we have energy like nothing. So we're there from, like, people would show up, like, at 10 in the morning from, like, around the neighborhood, and we'd be there all the way until, like, 6, just, like, all day, just, like, dancing, eating, like, going around, making trouble, coming back. Yeah, we had some hooligans, man. We had some guys that were, like, graffiti. They were taggers, so they was, like, all of a sudden, like, they would be gone. We're going to go 7-Eleven. All of a sudden, like, they're gone for an hour, and then they come back running, with, like, holding their pants up because they're wearing big pants. Like, cops are chasing us. Like, why? This dumbass stole, you know, stole cigarettes, because this is before, like, they mandated cigarettes behind the counters. This is when cigarettes were still, you could still grab them. And so, how old are you?
23.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were, like, doing shit like that. And so they were grabbing cigarettes and tagging and breaking windows and shit, and then running back to my friend's mom's house and then start breakdancing again after getting chased by the cops. And that was kind of pretty much, like, my, like, life for, like, those years. And Climax was actually at that time getting pretty well known. They linked up with Soul Control Crew around 97, so, like, my junior year. And that's when they met Crazy Cujo and Bar Mac, Mega Man, like, all these guys who were, like, Cujo was already by then. He was on that Run DMC versus Jason Nevins video. I don't know if you remember that video.
A little bit.
Yeah, it was, like, the girls versus the guys breakdancing video back in the 90s on MTV. He had already been on that video, and people, and he was, like, one of the most notable, like, dancers on that video, and they had just won Radiotron to Soul Control. And I think after that.
Did you, like, as this is happening, are you aware and it means something to you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, because we're, we were, like, their sparring partners in Fresno, and then they'd go out and then go battle other people, and then come back, and then you have this crew beef here still with all of us, and then they go out. And then, like, every so often we'd go out into, like, you know, go to the Bay or go to L.A. But we're going mainly just to soak up the culture and meet other dancers, and they're there for, like, blood, you know? They're there to actually, like, win battles, and they had the capabilities, and they won quite a few of them. And so we were aware that they were getting clout and being known, and all these underground videos start coming out, were, like, being circulated, and we're like, what the hell, Charles is on there? And he's like, he's in the final battle. It's like, what? It's like, you know, it's crazy to see that, because we're here and we're battling these dudes. We're giving them a tougher time sometimes battling than these other guys who are, like, from bigger cities. And it was like, you know, inspiring in ways, like, no, like, okay, like, if we can piss him off and make him crash and, like, get a leg up on one battle and walk away a winner one night, like, that's an accomplishment, because these dudes are, like, winning freestyle, like, international, like, contests. So it was pretty neat to be a part of that history in that way, where you're kind of, you know what's going on, you know what's being developed. Like, I personally, because I went to high school with them, I saw them develop a lot of those moves and push themselves to those levels of where they were able to go out and battle people from, you know, Switzerland. And yeah, they're already going out of country before even, you know, by the time they're 18, they're already heading out and battling people around the world. And we're just here, like, battling people around the state.
Did you guys see them as, like, representing Fresno?
In a way. In a way, yeah. But the beef was so thick, I think, like, we felt like we represented Fresno, too. So, and plus, too, we understood that we were more diverse as far as, like, ethnicity and socioeconomic background, and we felt like I don't know, like, we embodied Fresno more than they did as far as, like, what Fresno is and what it has. Because we had people that were still actively involved in gangs that were... Yeah, we had a guy, we named him Bulldog because he was a bulldog. So we just said, your brain-assy name is Bulldog. And, he, you know, he would show up, like, to a battle with, like, three other, like, legit, like, gangster dudes, some scary guys. And they'd be like, yeah, like, all cheering him on. It was really weird because you have him and then my friend Lawrence, who's a Japanese and African-American, but he was raised by his mom, who's African-American, and she was, like, a dance studio teacher. And so he was, like, and he was also, like, a black, well, not a black belt, but he was, like, competitive in karate. So you have this guy coming out of nowhere, like, has no idea what, he went to a private school and then started hanging out with us. So he's, like, out of, like, right. some left field, has no idea of our culture. And then my friend Dat, who's first generation American. And then I feel like we were more, we embodied Fresno more, but they were so good, it didn't matter. And them being with Soul Control, like, I think more people identified them being, like, Bay or L.A. than Fresno. It wasn't until, like, Charles and Pablo started getting really, really good and surpassing some of the L.A. guys where, like, Fresno started to be put on the map, like, legit. Because then, like, you know, you had people announcing them on videos, and it's like, Fresno, California, you know, Climax. And so that's when you start seeing it, especially in the Bay. I think that's where the real reputation for Fresno was built up, for breaking. So LA is a little different. I've always felt like LA had so many people coming in from so many other places, like, Fresno's not really going to matter, even if you're really good, just because you're in LA, you're in LA. That means you're from LA. Once you get there and you get good, that's it, you're from LA. It doesn't matter where you were from originally. Right. You are now a Los Angeles, you know, child. If you get good there and you get known there, where the Bay, like, recognized, because the Bay has their own little cliques already, like, your Oakland, East Oakland, San Francisco, Vallejo, you had areas like, I'm drawing a blank. They used to have Return of the B-Boy there, it had all these, like, jams there, Best of the Best, which was near San Jose, drawing a name, a blank in the name of the city, but you had all these regional areas, and they had also had their own styles. And Sacramento, of course, and then Modesto, where Style Elements is from, and they were, by this time, they were already won Battle of the Year in Germany. They had won Radiotron. They had beat Rocksteady at B-Boy Summit. So these guys are from Modesto, Stockton area. And I feel like
were they,
like,
all from Modesto?
Remind is from Stockton. Crumbs, I think, was from San Jose, but, like, somehow, like, went to Modesto. And you had Po One, who I think was originally from Puerto Rico, but somehow he was up there. Super Dave. I mean, I don't know the origin of all those guys, but they would all, like, for some reason, Modesto Stockton would always, when anytime you hear Style Elements, you'd always hear Modesto Stockton for some reason. I know mainly Modesto had to do with B-Boy Ivan. Had to do with him, and he would break with Style Elements, but he wasn't really a part of Style Elements. He was kind of like their Pokemon. He just come in and just, like, destroy everybody. But I felt like that's where Climax got their, put Fresno on the map up there.
So then did you guys see their success? Was it, like, cool? Like,
despite the, like, the beefs. Like, it was still pretty cool to see them, like, out there, to see someone that you know, that you go to school with, or, you know, you hang out with once in a while. Like, you see them, like, on a video that you know people all around the world are watching, because that community, that the B-Boy scene is so small back then that, like, if he's on that video, that means people know about him in Japan, people know about him in Germany, they know about him in England, wherever around the world, Brazil. Whoever's getting access to that video is going to know his name, you know, or know that name, Climax, Soul Control. And so it was inspiring in a way to see that. Like I said, you know, like, to know that we give them shit when they come back home and then they go out and they're still, like, killing it. It was pretty cool. It's just, like, a way having an indirect, you know, like, an indirect impact on what they were doing. Because I'm pretty sure us being here with them, like, put push them to another level because they don't want to get their asses whipped by us. Right. Obviously, it looked bad on them. So they would push themselves to another level. Like, right when, like, especially like my friend Dat, like, he would catch up in power move combinations. But right when he thinks he's catching up, all of a sudden, like, they're doing something whole new, a whole different move set. And so, like, he always, like, as good as my friend was, he always, like, in power move category, like, I think our whole crew, like, we always, like, lag behind them
right.
in that. And so to see, like, that they're actually kicking people's butts all over the world, and it was, like, it didn't make us feel that bad. They're coming here and, you know, doing stuff to us. It's, like, you know, it's cool.
You're going to lose. Might as well lose to the best.
Yeah, exactly. Might as well lose to someone who's, you know, is really good. Then like
some scrub.
Yeah, because then when scrubs would come around, like, we realized we're real quick because of Climax, like, for our crew, we realized where we were on the food chain. And by that time, we were a crew called Lunacy when they started doing, like, going around the world and stuff. We were called Lunacy, which is a crew that Mikey Ice brought. This is like a Filipino crew from the Bay. And he danced with them and somehow got permission. He was affiliated with them somehow and got permission to use that name and bought it into Fresno.
So Mikey Ice is from Fresno?
He's from I know he's from Madera.
Okay.
Yeah, he went to Madera High and everything. Mikey Ice is like 9 years older than me, somewhere up there. So, yeah, he's the one. That's when we're going by Lunacy. And that's when they started, like, Climax started pushing out and really doing some cool stuff.
Is Lunacy, like, still, like, the same core group, or is this new people?
Lunacy is gone. I know that they
I mean, like, when you guys went it.
No, we were second generation. Okay.
Was it mostly people from your other crew?
Yeah, it just carried over because okay. it was a lot of the garage kids. Okay. It was a lot of us from the garage. Because Mikey actually come over and he would sell his bootleg videos. And then he was like, oh, you know, we'd say, you stay and break with us, and he would. And he would say, hey, I'm going to start up Lunacy again if you guys want to be part of it. And so we did. And that's when, like, the things with Climax, like, really escalated, and Climax started bringing Soul Control members in to battle us. So we're getting, like, these internationally known B-boys coming in and, like, to battle us now. So it was pretty crazy. Like, they brought in Mega Man, and Mega Man's from the Bay. And we're just like, we just know him by name. Like, oh, yeah, Sean Mega Man. Like, watch out, that guy's really good. Blah, blah, blah. And then they bring him in. So it's like Climax, Lunacy. It was also mainly like me and whoever I was hanging out with at the time versus Climax for some reason. Like, because all these crews, like, I either created or I was, like, one of the main people. And other people would, like, drop out. But it was always, like, me and then, like, remnants of other people kind of trailing along. So I felt like maybe it was like a beef against me. So, like, I don't sound self-centered, but I felt like it was mainly what it was. And I wasn't even the best person in my crew, but for some reason they always had it out for me. Like, I had people that were way better in my crew, but they'd always target me.
Were you battling as a popper or
breaking? By that time I was breakdancing.
Okay.
I was tired of getting whooped and looking stupid. And so I started trying to, like, actually learn stuff on the floor around that time. I think I identified as both still around that time. I was, like, turning 18. I still identified as a popper and a breaker. Didn't really have – I could have went either way at that time. It wasn't until, like, after, I think, once I graduated, I was like, now I'm just a B-boy. And I started doing that for a lot of years. And that beef with Climax, Soul Control, like – carried all the way until like 2004, 2005 when Pablo Flores passed away. And then it was like then we kind of like, I think I just kind of squashed it. But it carried on, that thing carried on for almost 10 years, man. Like me with a bunch of different crews and just all these heated battles. And these battles were pretty big. Those are like, and people who weren't even dancing got passionate about it when trying to get involved in our fights and beefs and stuff and girls. It was really dramatic, man. Like it could have been like a little like mini series, to be honest, because it'd be like a girl who like would date one of us or something, and then all of a sudden she would we'd like, let's say like one of us, like I was with a girl in the dumpster and she'd get pissed and then go date someone from Climax and then show up to a jam with this guy and then she'd be like all decked out and like all not only is she dating, now she's learning how to break dance. You're just like, what's going on? Or they'd be like someone's bigger brother coming, like want to fight everybody. It would get really dramatic and really like, yeah, like I said, it'd be like a little teen, like mini series or whatever of about dancers. And it was really weird because, like, I think our battle Lunacy versus Climax was like 1999 at Holmes Playground. We had, I want to say, almost 200 people packed in that gym to watch a breakdancing battle and a local breakdancing battle.
It was just, are these like organized ahead of time or is just like show up?
That
tomorrow?
One was one of the first organized like crew on crew battles, but Climax had already been doing something before then called Hip Hop in a Park. Hmm. And the first Hip Hop in the Park that I remember was in 98. And people from the Bay came down. That's when I started getting exposure to like other styles and other people, like LA. Because by then they had already been cool. They already had been in Soul Control. So they had connections with all these out of town guys, and yeah.
Where was that held at?
Holmes Playground. Mm. Yeah, I think two or three of them were at Holmes Playground.
Would that be in the gym or outside?
Gym and outside. Yeah, the first one was outside, and I won second place in the popping competition for that one. And these guys from out of town won first place in the breaking, and local guys. We rarely placed because you had like people from out of town coming in. It was just like they were on some like other level with like Climax. But that's the exposure I got. It was Hip Hop in the Parks. And then they had one in the gym, and that was the biggest one that they had, and that was 99. And that one had B-Boy Ivan, which I don't know if you're familiar with Ivan.
A little bit.
Yeah, he's probably one of the better known B-Boys, like one of the like legends now. But he was judging. And you had guys from Tracy coming down. I remember there's a crew called Mad Action Crew. You had Soul Control Crew. You had Rock Force. You had, like, all these different. And Rock Force had just won Battle of the year prior.
Wow.
Battle of the Year 98. So they were there, like, all these people in Fresno. Mm-hmm. Like, coming. That's when Fresno's, because of Climax and because they had built up so much of a reputation, they started able to get people in here. And that's when I started getting exposure to all these bigger names and bigger people, which encouraged me later to start going to, like, B-Boy Summit and stuff like that, the freestyle session.
So can you maybe just kind of describe, like, what that looks like for someone who hasn't been to, like, these battles? Like, when Lunacy and Climax kind of go head-to-head, what is that?
Well, basically, so, like, when you go to, like, call them jams, when you go to these jams, like for these battles, they were flyered, this one was flyered heavily, and we were the main event, but we had, like, a contest, we had a two-on-two also, and you just kind of walk in, and it's only in the gymnasium. The other activities in the park that they usually do, like rec center, still going on in other parts of the park, but we have the gym for the event. Someone's at the door charging, you know, like a little cover charge. Like, I think it was like we like charged like $2 or something like that just to pay for cleanup. And you come in, and there's just like little like circles of course Climax and Lunacy at the time were in different parts of the gym. We did not even go in each other's circles. We were just like already pissed at each other because we're gonna battle. It's like a heated thing. But you got people who are friends with both of the crews who know us, so they kind of, like, walk around, socialize. And it's in a gymnasium, so you got bleachers set up. You got people sitting on bleachers, you know, taking pictures and stuff. You got people who already have kids, too, you know. And so you got, you know, little rugrats running around. I would say it was, like, pretty family-friendly for the most part. Like, it was, even though there was that beef there, it was still a community. And people were still supportive. It depended on what side of the fence you're on, of course, but like all in all, I still felt like it was a community, and it was the big picture for me was it was still supporting hip hop, and it was still supporting, you know, breaking, and to being, you know, 17 years old and able to throw an event out of nowhere and it brings 200 people, mm-hmm. for me it was like a pretty big accomplishment. especially back then, Fresno wasn't that big. And to, like, know that there was all these people here just for us, like, to watch us, these two crews battle was pretty, humbling in a way. It was like, wow, you guys really think this of us, like, of breakdancing, you guys, you know? And a lot of people weren't dancers. They never had dance, right. Had nothing to do with dancing. They were all about what we were putting on. So you had all these different types of people in this gym just waiting. They were watching the two-on-two battles. You had people from Sanger show up from, you know, all the South Valley, Selma, Dinuba, Madera. You had all these little, like, guys. And these, you know, you don't really want, I don't want to disrespect them, call them scrubs, but they weren't, like, to the level we were already at, like, for the main event. They were, like, the undercard, basically. But they were all, you know, real cool people, and they would bring people from, their cities out. And it's just all these different, like, it's a diverse group of people that all happen to know how to breakdance or like breakdancing. It's all showing up to a place in the hood, a park in the hood to watch. And the battle was, like, it took up the half court. So I remember our backs were kind of, like, against the wall, the half court. And the DJ was behind us. And then Climax was across, and it was just like this huge, like, circle, like, mainly like a half circle. And it was like 200 people just watching. And the battle went on, and I want to say carried on for like 30 to 40 minutes or something like that.
So is this like kind of one-to-one kind of coming out?
Or yeah. Yeah, no routines or anything.
No choreography?
Right? No choreography back then. It was just mainly just do what you got, and that's it. So, yeah, carried on for a long time. It was just all, at that time, it was all just breakdancing and doing any popping, because I had stopped by then, and so we were just doing breaking.
So who won?
I have to see the video again, but the guy who threw it on, he liked us more. I think he picked us on purpose. Mm-hmm. And then my friend who had passed away, he was, like, on the microphone. I don't know who gave him the microphone, but he was one of the, his name was Biggie, and he's... His name wasn't just a clever name. This dude was a big guy. And so he was like, if I want to talk on the microphone, I'm going to take the microphone. Right. And so he was like, the winner is. And for some reason, the gym lights turned off. So I don't know if he set something up and then lights turned off. He goes, lunacy. And then all of a sudden, like, you hear, like, people from Climax side, like, what the hell? And, nah, fuck. They, like, yelling and cussing. And you hear, like, scrambling. Like, there's going to be a fight. Oh, man. People who were, like, weren't even involved with breaking or even in the crew or related people in the crew were trying to fight, dang, like, outside, like, yelling at each other. It was it was like a fight that got called, like, a bad UFC fight. Like, someone who, like, shouldn't have won. Like, they got cheated on the cards, and that was it. So we won officially with the announcement, but I'm pretty sure, like, if I look at it, Climax probably won the battle. They had better moves. I won't dispute that at all. So yeah, but somehow it turned into like another like event. It was like Climax versus Lunacy 2, and that one was way smaller because by the time everyone was tired of the fighting and stuff. But that one I felt like we won, and. By that time, he was the only power mover we really had. He was always catch up. And that time, he had caught up. He was doing some pretty amazing stuff. He was doing head spins. While he was doing head spins, he's hopping on his head. Like, so he's bouncing while he's spinning at the same time. So he was doing some insane stuff. Yeah. He was doing some insane moves. And he had a lot of the ground walks. So he had this one... where it's kind of, are you familiar with, like, so you know what a crickets are, or crab walks?
Yeah.
So you know the one-handed one, the jackhammers? He'd be able to do that, but with his legs, like, straight, like, instead of being crossed in like this, he'd have his legs just, like he's, like, basically, like, straight.
Like planking.
And just hop, planking, yep, and just hopping, boom, boom, boom. And that into, like, and just push up into a halo and then drop into windmill. So he was, by that time, he was, like, our ace in the hole. And Charles was actually living in Fremont at the time. So, like, one of their main, like, heavy hitters was out of commission. So, yeah, and that was the Lunacy saga. And then it's like Dragon Ball Z. So there's that. And then all of a sudden, that's why Charles' name is probably Goku.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, like, we have a new one where it's like I start this crew called Circle Junkies, and there's like maybe like four members left from, or five members left from Lunacy, and it's like another batch of B-Boys that come along. And like that turns into like a whole other thing. And like that time, that's when I started throwing my own events. Like, and that's when Sam and Hectic came along. And so like Aaron's doing stuff with Sam, and they have FDK opens up, that hip hop store in Visalia. And so they started doing they carried on the hip hop in the parks, because the guy who was throwing them moved out of town. So they took over the name. But they turned it into like actual hip hop, so it wasn't just dancing anymore. It was they have graffiti expos, they have MC battles and B-boy battles.
Where are those, at the same place? Home still or?
No, this starts traveling. This is when it gets bigger, like as far as like Central Valley, like Visalia and their park, they had it. And then they have like a veterans hall. Mm-hmm. And they had a few of the events, but they were calling them hip hop in the park, and then it transitioned from hip hop in the park and they started calling them street rock. And the street rock events, one was actually that's when you can start finding stuff on YouTube. Like, these videos are on YouTube. But street rock had Visalia. I remember there was one in a skate park in, I want to say Hanford. There was a skate park there, and we had it like actually in the skate park in the middle, and everyone was like on top, and you know, like the bowl.
Yeah.
So the dancers are in the bowl, the judges and all the crowd are just like on top, and there's a piece of linoleum just like battling down there. So it's like, if it's your time to like battle, you like step into the pit.
Nice.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Drop in.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. So yeah, they started doing those events, and then I think 2001 they had the first urban combat here at the Satellite State Union. I didn't get to go to that one. I had a funeral that day. And all my friends had got locked out for some reason.
Oh, no.
Like, it got so packed that most of the dancers couldn't even get in there. So I don't know what the capacity is for Satellite State Union, but it was at capacity. Okay. And that was their first big jam. And then, so the street rocks were, like, the preliminaries. And then urban combat was, like, always the main, was, like, the Super Bowl of the breakdance battles. And so they would have them in little areas, like, you know, there was a one in Fresno that had an orchid hall, which is what they call the Asian village in the southeast side. It's all these, like, stores. Like, they have, like, a Hmong grocery store. They have, like, some other, like, kind of like a Kimbo, like a Laos store, like Laotian food. And so this is all just Asian stuff. And they had a place called Orchid Hall where they would have their little, like, you know, social events. And they actually rented that out for a street rock. And, that's where my crew had won first place. And then Climax Soul Control had won the street rock prior.
Okay.
So here comes Urban Combat 2 at Fresno State in 2003. And you have people from the first Urban Combat, or second Urban Combat, there's three Urban Combats. Urban Combat 1 is the one we didn't get into. Urban Combat 2, Flexible Flay from Sacramento won. They actually beat Climax and took first. We were in the semifinals. My crew was Circle Junkies by then. We were in semifinals with them. We got eliminated, and they battled Climax, and they beat Climax. The Urban Combat 3, which was the last Urban Combat, the finals were Circle Junkies, my crew, and Climax Soul Control. And that one was really big. That one, there's actually, if you go on YouTube, there's a little video montage of all the crews that were there. And it was really packed, too. We were almost at capacity. Because I remember there was, the crowd started going to the stage to watch. And then, like, the whole area. And that was, like, I want to say one of the last bigger events that Fresno saw for breakdancing. They had one more street rock in Visalia. And that was at their convention center. And that one, they brought a lot of people from out of town. Like, there was a lot of B-boys that were already going to Japan. They were like Climax Soul Control on that level, so no one locally won or even mattered at that event. It was kind of like we're like on the sidelines watching these like heavy hitters. It's like Conor McGregor coming into 559 fights.
Right.
Yeah, so it was just like you're just watching all these dudes like, I'm just gonna sit here and drink my Red Bull and watch this, because you know, get my ass whooped and this so you just watched. I think that's where kind of like, that was their last big event, and they lost a lot of support locally because they were trying to be they were trying to be like a freestyle session or B-Boy Summit, but without really supporting the local guys anymore. And that's kind of like where I like lost my, that's when I stopped supporting like Sam and Hectic and what they were doing, because it was like your whole like, the reason why you were built up is because you supported local hip hop, and you're kind of veering away from that to support, you know, you want to be bigger, you want to be like a Cross One or, you know, an Asia One, you want to be these people, these big promoters, and you're forgetting that Fresno, you know, the Central Valley doesn't have that. We're not at that level. Most of us aren't at that level where we can keep up, and you're going to kind of just leave us on the back burner, and that's what they did. Hmm. And it was unfortunate. You know, I wish that, like, we had the exposure early enough to get good as most of the other guys, but we didn't.
Yeah.
You know, we're at our own levels, and it started kind of falling apart after that. Events, like, there was no events for a long time. I think there was like one other event, this dance studio through, and it was my crew and Climax again, because we were the only ones like capable of battling each other, and we won that one. And after that, yeah, nothing for a long time. You know, Pablo had passed away, and well, no one was really doing anything. Like, break dancing for a long time was on a standstill. It wasn't until I started throwing my own events that it picked back up. And that was like 2009.
Is that when you started throwing events, or you didn't anything before that?
I had thrown one event before that in 2001 at Holmes Playground. And like, I think maybe 30 people showed up. Mm-hmm. it wasn't really anything. It was like right before they started doing the street rocks.
Okay.
And so everyone kind of just, because they had actually had a budget.
That helps.
Yeah. I mean, I had like $20 for Kinko's and my friend's pager voicemail. And that was it. There was no budget. So nothing. And then by a little bit after that, they had established centralcali.com.
Yeah.
So there was that hip hop site, and it was just a form, you know, the old school forms. You just go on, you have your little ID, and then you just kind of talk on there. So once that came along, that's when I think that helped Street Rock out a lot, because there was no other social media at that time,
right?
No MySpace, nothing. So that pushed, everyone would get their information off of there and go to the events. And so they built up that scene for, I think they, for like, I want to say like 3 years, had a pretty cool little thing going on in Fresno, and then just plateaued, and that was it.
Yeah. Urban Con, they were bringing out artists too, though. Like,
yeah, the first one is that, I think that's why it was.
Hyro come out or something?
Hmm?
Didn't like Hyro come out or?
Yeah, that was the second one. Mm. Mm-hmm. And that was another thing that they were doing, was they were trying to like successfully blend all the elements into one event, and they didn't realize that like break down, like the B-boy, like the B-boy scene, just no matter where you go, doesn't really mesh well with the MC scene. Mm. It never has. I mean, I remember on a freestyle session, they brought Rakim, and I thought it was going to be like a bigger crowd for Rakim, and it wasn't. There, the battles had more people. As soon as the battles ended, most people left.
Wow.
It was like, for Rakim, and it was just like crazy. I think the following year, they had Black Eyed Peas. This is before Fergie.
Right.
And,
it's an important distinction.
Yeah, exactly. They had them, and it was like the same thing. Mm. Like, no one, like, it's just that, it felt like that. It's a really weird thing, because it is hip-hop, and it is the same culture, but it's a different scene.
So from Roosevelt on, what are you mostly dancing to, like music?
Say like 70s soul music. A lot of like the Afro-Cuban beats. A lot of the Latin jazz. And then straight up soul, like, you know, James Brown.
So break stuff.
Yeah. So all the like classic break beats, but then you get like some newer producers and stuff. I mean, there was Breakestra. They're like not contemporary anymore, but they came out like late 90s. and they were doing stuff. And then you dance to like Jurassic 5. I mean, they had put up stuff, you know, like some of Mos Def beats were cool. So like some contemporary hip hop too. And then you got Eric B and Rakim. That's like you can't go wrong with any of their stuff because it's sampled from all the breaks.
Right.
So like Public Enemy, like anything like with that feel, you know, Leaders of the New School. You got Tribe Called Quest. You got what EPMD, like all that kind of stuff, all that good old hip hop. We danced to that too, and kind of just maintained that same rotation for a long time. It wasn't until like the internet became widely available where the palette changed a little. And started getting these obscure like artists from, you know, like Denmark or something, like that were doing funk, and they're doing James Brown funk in the 90s for some reason. And so you get all these tracks out of nowhere, or just like people who are just crate, these DJs are just crate digging and finding like cool stuff. I mean, we danced to like DJ Shadow too. Like he was a pretty, like his CD. And DJ Andy Smith, who's the DJ for Portishead, he put up, I think it was called The Document. That's the name of his album. And then Moby had a B-side album that came out that had a lot of, it was just all the stuff that he sampled. And he put together like a compilation of all his samples, the original tracks, and it had a lot of good breakbeats on there too. There's a lot of that stuff being rotated. And with popping, it's always been like Cameo. Like I've always been like rootsy, like funk style dancer. So like I always stuck to like Cameo, Zapp and Roger, some Prince, like Morris Day, like all that kind of like funk.
Yeah. Nice. Well, taking a lot of our time, anything we missed or anything you want to get on record?
Not that I can think of, man.
That's great. Well, it's a lot of... We may have to kind of put a descriptor of what a pager is, but other than that...
I know, right? That's why I asked, I was like, how old are you? Yeah. Yeah, tobacco used to be... It wasn't always behind the shelves. Like, my friend used to snag stuff all the time.